In the first hour today, we will be talking about America's space program, something about where from where we've come and where we're headed. And our guest for the program is John Logsdon. He's director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, where he is also professor of political science and international affairs. He's going to be visiting the campus tomorrow to talk on the topic Humans in Space, Past, Present, and Future. This is the William Showalter Science and Technology Policy Seminar. It's sponsored by the College of Engineering. He'll be giving his talk tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. in room 141 of the Loomis Laboratory of Physics on the U of I campus. And I'm sure anyone who is listening should feel welcome if they'd like to go and hear what he has to say. Also, of course, here on this program, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they are brief. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone who's listening is welcome to call with a question. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Dr. Logsdon is author of the book, The Decision to Go to the Moon, Project Apollo and the National Interest. He's also general editor of the 8-volume series, Exploring the Unknown, Selected Documents in the History of the U.S. Civil Space Program. And he's written many articles and reports on space policy and history. Recently, he served as a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. He's also a former member of the NASA Advisory Council and current member of the Commercial Space Transportation Advisory Committee of the Department of Transportation. He is also former chairman of the Committee on Science and Public Policy of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Logsdon, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
That introduction makes me sound old.
Oh, I'm sure that, and that's just a fraction of all the things that you have done. So we really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Sure.
I hope that you wouldn't mind spending at least a little time about talking, going back and talking a little bit about what happened with the shuttle Columbia. I guess the thing that really is very striking when I look at what has been written about the report that the board put out was the concern that NASA was not concerned enough about the issue of safety. And I was very struck by a comment one of your fellow members made about the fact that they thought that NASA had stopped thinking about the shuttle as an experimental vehicle, that perhaps that led to some thinking that this was, you know, a shuttle launch and return was just routine. And apparently you can't ever think about it that way.
Now, human spaceflight is one of the most difficult things that society does in terms of the care needed to make sure it's safe. The board started out in the immediate aftermath of the accident last February the 1st, thinking that it was going to do just a normal accident investigation, what technically went wrong and how do you prevent that from happening in the future. And as the board got started, its original members found that the problems were much deeper than that, and they were rooted in the original design of the shuttle, in the political context within which the shuttle was operating, and NASA as an organization and its bad habits. And so someone like me with not a technical background but a lot of background in the history and policy aspects of space was asked to join the board. It was actually a year ago, March the 5th. And what we found was in fact, that NASA, to meet a bunch of external requirements and top-level management requirements, had changed its thinking about what the shuttle was to say that the actual shuttle matched the promises that had been made to be routine access to space, when indeed it was anything but routine.
There only ever were five shuttles, and now, sadly, two of the five have been lost, Columbia and almost 20 years ago, Challenger. And I think that there also apparently was some concern among the people who were involved in this investigation that these two events, the loss of Challenger and of Columbia, were not unrelated in the sense that some of the same factors apply. But that means that whatever should have been done 20 years ago when Challenger was lost apparently hadn't been done, And those problems were still there all these years later. Does that make you at all optimistic for the future here now, that these kinds of things could be corrected?
Well, NASA made some changes after the Challenger accident in 1986 that were good changes, and then in the early 90s seemed to unlearn them and fall back into bad habits. So there was, and one of my colleagues on the board, Sally Ride, who was also on the Rogers Commission that investigated the Challenger accident, in one of our public hearings made the comment, "I'm hearing echoes of Challenger." And we looked into that and came to the unfortunate conclusion that there were too many parallels in terms of organizational behavior. Can NASA reform itself so that it can operate the shuttle safely? I believe it can. We put out some rather harsh criticism and stringent requirements for what NASA ought to be doing. The NASA management has said that it is going to honor and go beyond every one of our recommendations. The recent president's policy calls for retiring the space shuttle within the next 6 to 7 years, and so it seems to me, as not speaking for the board, but as an individual, that NASA can operate this system for another few years and operate it safely.
Mm-hmm. After the loss of Challenger, the shuttle was grounded for 3 years. Now NASA apparently is talking about a relaunch now in September, and that it's
that's
changed. Okay, well yeah. then I'm out of that. That was the last thing that I read. So right. What are they thinking now?
It's no earlier than March the 6th of next year.
Of next year, okay.
So that would be a 25 month grounding. It's coming up on the length of time the shuttle was grounded post Challenger. There's one big difference in 1986 through 88. There was no external pressure to launch the shuttle. Where now we have the International Space Station circling the Earth every 90 days in a kind of holding operation, waiting for assembly to restart. And so there is more pressure now to get back flying as soon as it's safe than there was in 1986.
Well, is that enough time, do you think, to fix whatever needs to be fixed?
Well, I think so. The world is watching, maybe even to a greater degree than was true post-Challenger. The second time it's worse. There is a very expert group headed by two very senior ex-astronauts, Tom Stafford and Dick Covey, overseeing the return-to-flight process. The Columbia Board has let it be known if we're asked to come back together a year or so after our report, we're willing to do that. So I think the scrutiny is there in terms of whether NASA has made the changes necessary. And I don't think that there's a they don't really have to redesign much compared to what they had to do after Challenger. So they should be able to make the schedule.
Hmm. Our guest this morning in this first part of Focus 580 is John Logsdon from George Washington University, from the Space Policy Institute there at the Elliott School of International Affairs. As I mentioned at the beginning, he was a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. He's also a former member of the NASA Advisory Council and a leading expert on the history and analysis of space policy. He's written a lot about that, spoken a lot about it. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think probably people should have now have heard the story of what happened with Columbia. That is that on launch, a piece of foam insulation from the external fuel tank, this big sort of orange-brown kind of big tank that the orbiter rides on, piece of this insulation came off and hit the leading edge of the left wing of the orbiter. It was a piece that weighed less than 2 pounds, apparently, but was going at something more than 500 miles an hour and cut a hole in the wing. And then on reentry, the hot gases that form around the shuttle as it's coming through the atmosphere got into the wing, destroyed it from the inside, and that led to the loss of the shuttle. Is now the thinking that it would be possible in the future to, if there was that kind of damage, to actually be able to spot it and then develop a way so that the astronauts in the shuttle could actually go out and fix it before reentry?
Yes. I mean, one of our recommendations and one of the realities is that almost every future shuttle mission will go to the International Space Station. The one exception was the now canceled servicing mission to Hubble Space Telescope. We may want to come back and talk about that.
Sure.
So one of our recommendations is that NASA have in-orbit repair capability for both the tiles and the reinforced carbon-carbon, the RCC, which is the leading edge, and other places on the shuttle that get exposed to the highest temperatures, that the shuttle be able to dock with the station and conduct a very extensive inspection at the station, that we use our, I guess I can say, spy telescopes, euphemistically called our national assets, to take images of the shuttle to see whether there's been any damage, and that's going to be done on every mission, and that if there's really a problem that can't be fixed, that the crew can stay aboard the station for several months until a rescue mission can be launched. So I think we provide defense in depth against this particular kind of accident. The problem is that the most likely next accident would be something else, and we tried very hard to anticipate those something else's and give guidance to NASA to be thinking about how to avoid them.
And I guess the other thing that was at least being discussed, if not a decision that had been made, is that when one shuttle is launched, they're going to have another one ready to go in case that should be necessary.
Yeah, ready is a kind of loose term. the current policy is to have another shuttle capable of launching within 60 to 90 days. Okay. So, you know, the image of another shuttle out on the launch pad to be launched in a few days is wrong. With the schedule that the shuttle is going to have to meet once it returns to flight, they're going to be flying every 3 or 4 months anyway. So this is not much extra to have a shuttle ready to conduct a rescue mission, should one, in a very extreme possibility, be necessary.
The problem that led to the loss of the Columbia, this with pieces of foam insulation coming off of the fuel tank, has happened before. They'd seen it happen before, and without it being a problem, and apparently that was also part of what was going on here. They said, well, we've seen foam come off and hit the orbiter before, and it's not a problem, so maybe they weren't as worried about it as they should have been, which then gets to this question, is it also possible to engineer that foam insulation on that big tank so that it's not going to come off?
Well, you said in kind of the introduction to this segment that one of the problems was treating the shuttle as an operational rather than an experimental vehicle, and this is a good example of it. Foam had come off on every mission. Large pieces of foam had come off on several missions. It didn't hurt the orbiter in those earlier missions, and NASA adopted the posture that the foam couldn't hurt you because it hadn't hurt you to date. That's not what you would do if it were an experimental vehicle. You'd understand what was happening. You'd understand the possibilities and take action. We more or less forced NASA to give us a piece of the actual leading edge and let us shoot foam at it at the same velocity, and what happened was a 16-inch hole. So we certainly demonstrated the foam could hurt you. NASA, again, didn't do the research to understand foam shedding. They think they understand it now in the aftermath of the accident and are taking steps to make sure it doesn't happen again.
We have some folks with questions here. Well, let's start out with a caller from Springfield, I believe, line number one. Hello.
Thank you very much. I would like to have you comment on my thought that the president's proposal to put man on the moon and on Mars is just politically motivated and not really scientifically based at all. And the connection between that and the fact that they're proposing to take the Hubble Space Telescope out of operation, which I consider to be an awful travesty, because it's a beautiful connection between pure science and the people, the ability of people to understand and appreciate the science and wonder of space. And isn't what's going on in the current administration and their response to the space program really a travesty? Thank you. I'll just take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, the caller raises all the big questions here about what it is we're doing and what and where we're going.
We could do that for the rest of the show.
We could indeed. Well, go ahead.
We haven't talked yet about the president's proposed space exploration initiative, so I'll try to summarize it real quickly. On January the 14th of this year, President Bush laid out a very sweeping and comprehensive vision for the future of space exploration. Was that politically motivated? Well, nothing a president does in an election year or almost any time does not have politics associated with it. But I think it was really a reaction, and here's the connection, to a criticism at the end of our report, of the Columbia Board's report, where we said that the failure to provide a compelling vision to guide human spaceflight was a failure of national leadership. That criticism came in our report in the end of August last year. In September, the White House launched a very closed but very high-level review of what to do in reaction to that comment. And that was the proximate cause of the president's announcement. So it wasn't driven by election politics, just to get this in early. It was not driven by a reaction to the fact that China was putting a human into space. It was a reaction to the recognition that if we were going to have a human spaceflight program, it had to be for a good reason, that we were not going to just, for trivial reasons, accept the risks and costs of putting people into space. It is unfortunate, I think, that the decision not to fly the fourth Hubble servicing mission has been linked to this president's announcement. There is a connection, but it's not a one-on-one connection. The issue in my mind is we talked about the repair capability if we're going to a space station. The repair capability to repair the shuttle is less if you don't go to the space station, if, for example, you went to Hubble for a servicing mission. So there are slightly increased risks associated with the Hubble servicing mission. And there is, I think, an overriding desire to retire the shuttle as quickly as possible and stop taking the risks. One more mission to Hubble was a risky mission. So it was I think NASA Administrator O'Keefe has said, a razor-thin decision to make the trade-off between keeping the Hubble in service another 3 or 4 years compared to not flying that mission. It was a tough call.
I hope that gets to the questions of the caller. Let's go on to someone else. And I'm sure we'll get back to some of these things. But let's go next to a caller in Urbana, and this would be line two.
Hello? Hi there. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering what would be the problem with, like, putting a $600 camcorder on the arm, since the doors to the bay are open. They could just inspect it themselves. Having that in mind, I was also wondering if they did incur some damage in liftoff, why they couldn't just resupply it and have it move to the space station and just become part of the space station.
Right. The shuttle post-accident is going to have a longer arm. The reality is that the Canada arm on the current shuttle is not long enough to guide a camera to every place on the vehicle that might have critical damage. I'm sure it's not going to be $600. This is the space after all. But there will be the capability to do in-orbit inspections from the shuttle in addition to what you could do on the station. The reason that Columbia could not go to the station is because it was in a different orbit, a 36-degree, I don't want to be held to that, inclined to the equator instead of 51.6 degrees. And the energy required to shift orbital planes in space is really very substantial and beyond the shuttle's capability. It just could, it's not like an airplane. You can't just bank and fly a different place because of the laws of physics. You're not flying up there. You're under the influence of Kepler's laws, and it just was not practical, even if they had known the damage was there, to get to the station.
Are you saying that it couldn't be refueled in space, and wouldn't it be cheaper to refuel it in space?
No, it can. It could not be refueled in space. This is millions of pounds of, well, first of all, it's not the main engines that would do the orbital plane change. It would be the
maneuvering rockets.
Orbital maneuvering system, and it just didn't have the power to do that.
Oh, well, that's my question. Thanks.
Okay, well, sure. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. And if you would be listening on the Internet in the United States, you can also use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Let me just again very quickly reintroduce our guest, John Logsdon. He's director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, and is a leading expert on the history and analysis of space policy. He has done a lot of writing and speaking about it, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he's been a member of a number of boards and commissions. He was most recently a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. Let's talk a little bit more about the president's proposal. He, as you said, near the beginning of the year, proposed that the United States return to the moon, establish a permanent base there, and then at some point after that go on to Mars. Leaving aside the questions that people always raise about whether or not we should and whether that's an appropriate way to spend money, let's talk about the technical challenges that would be involved. We have a number of problems. First of all, we don't have the launch vehicles anymore to do it. We no doubt would have to build a lot of new hardware to do it. And there's an awful lot of things probably we need to know about living long-term in space that we don't quite yet know. What exactly would be involved, supposing that we just say we wanted to go back to the moon and have some long-term presence on the moon? We'll leave Mars because that's even
right.
more difficult. But just the first part of it, what exactly would be involved in doing that if we indeed decided that's what we wanted to do?
Well, first of all, although what you just said is what most people reporting on this have said, there's nothing in the president's policy that talks about permanent bases on the moon. What it says is increasingly longer stays. So it's a judgment to be made of whether it's worthwhile having people there on a permanent basis. That's one of the reasons we go. You know, it might go for a week or two to start out with, and then a month or two, and build up to a long duration emplacement, and the requirements obviously are different the longer you want to stay. There are two answers to your question, though, David. One is in the way that this policy is set forth, the main reason for going back to the moon is to test out systems, to gain experience, and perhaps even to find resources relevant to going to Mars. It's not moon as an end in itself, but moon as a stepping stone to Mars. So that's one line of thinking that says, why go back to the moon? The other says that the moon is a scientifically interesting place, and you can do some very interesting science from the moon. Launch vehicles. There are some holes in the president's proposal, and that's one of them, is that there was no decision made on how we will actually launch what it is that we will use to get to the people to the moon. And until we understand what that system will look like, we won't know how to launch it. There is a proposal to develop a brand-new spacecraft called the Crew Exploration Vehicle, which almost certainly will look a bit like an old Apollo capsule. It'll be capsules, not a winged vehicle, but with modern electronics, modern life support and all of that, which will be the key to taking the crew from Earth to the moon. NASA's established a new Office of Exploration Systems, and its first job is defining the requirements for that system and then letting the U.S. industry look at alternate designs. So anything that you would say about it now would be semi-imaginary. We don't know how many people it's going to carry. We're not going to know how big it is, how heavy it is. But the idea is that this vehicle, signally or in combination, would be the key to taking people beyond Earth orbit and back to the moon. We may be able to launch it with heavy lift versions of existing rockets. There may be a decision to take the shuttle main engines and the external tank and the solid rockets and make a heavy lift booster without people aboard on that. Those are the kind of issues that need to be worked over the next few years.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that within the scientific community, the consensus is that it's doable. It's not that these are insurmountable problems.
Right.
It's just a matter of applying our expertise and also spending the money.
Well, and the moon is just an offshore island. I mean, if you run into trouble on the moon, you can be home in 2 or 3 days. It's a different proposition, as you said earlier, than going to Mars. Mm.
Well, just if we just think about going back to the moon, has someone got sort of a ballpark estimate of how long it would take to do that and what it would cost?
Well, it's in the policy that we will return to the moon between 2015 and 2020. So this is obviously not Apollo. It's not a crash effort. We're talking about a minimum of 11 years, maximum of 16 years to do this. The cost numbers are a little elusive because it depends on what you include in the cost numbers. The numbers I've seen are between $60 and $75 billion just to get the initial mission to the moon, including the development of this new spacecraft and its launch capabilities. And that's, if you correct, somewhat less than it took us to do Apollo.
Mm. So, yeah, that actually was going to be my best question. My next question, if you could put it in today's dollars, how would that compare with when we went there before?
Yeah, Apollo was $22 billion through Apollo 11 in the money of the 1960s. So that has to be close to $200 billion today's dollar.
Going to Mars is the difficulty is compounded. Certainly one problem, as you note, is it's a lot further. It's going to take further to get there, further to come back. I don't know. Is the Martian surface an any more hostile place to live on than the moon?
Well, in a sense, it's less hostile. We know now that there has been lots of water there. We don't know how much water, if any, is on the moon. Mars has an atmosphere and has a third gravity instead of this 1/6 gravity of the moon. So in many ways, Mars is a slightly more hospitable, it's not a Caribbean island, but slightly more hospitable to human habitation. Of course, you still couldn't breathe the atmosphere. By the time we get ready to go to Mars, we will have made a decision whether to develop nuclear rockets, a nuclear propulsion that could cut the travel time down to a month instead of 6 to 9 months. You know, one of the fears is exposing the crew on the way out and back to high levels of radiation, and in particular on the way out, keeping them in good enough condition so that when they get to Mars, they're able to do useful work. So there are lots of the jargon word is bioastronautics. Lots of research to be done on the impact of long-duration spaceflight on humans, and that's what the U.S. has said it's going to use the space station for once it's completed.
Hmm. All right. We have some other callers here, local. We'll go next to a caller in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I recall hearing or reading that they sort of fell away from the redundancy concept in design. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but would you care to comment on that?
Well, I got to be careful talking about engineering because I'm not an engineer. And so I'm not quite sure exactly what you're referring to when you say about the redundancy concept in design. I mean, the desire in a so-called human-rated launch vehicle or spacecraft is to have redundancy whenever possible, and double or triple redundancy is better than single redundancy, so that if one thing fails, the whole thing does not fail. There are certain points in a mission. I'll give you one example from history. There was only one engine to get astronauts off the moon after they had finished their missions in Apollo. And if that didn't work, they were in big trouble. So that was a single, no redundancy sort of item. You try to avoid these in the design of spacefaring vehicles because the consequences of failure are so great.
Let's go to another call. This is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah. If I were forced to back a manned mission, it'd be sending men to the far side of the moon and in some sort of colony and setting up various kinds of telescopes, which have been dreamed about for a long time. And I don't know if that's maybe part of the reason they don't want to, you know, they're kind of thinking in those terms in that keeping Hubble up. But I wanted to ask you two other questions, though. And that is, I read a press release stating that something I hadn't heard of. I'd heard that the immune systems of the astronauts somehow gets don't function as well in weightlessness. And to add to that, I recently read that it turns out that various common pathogens like Salmonella become more virulent when grown in simulated microgravity. That was a release out of NASA. I was wondering if you could talk about that, but the really difficult question, I imagine, would be this one, and that is, I've heard more and more about how this administration favors the militarization of space, and I'd be really against that, and could you talk about that as well?
Sure. Let's see.
About virulent...
I understand the question. I'm just figuring out where to start. Let me start with your remark. One reason for going back to the moon, I said earlier, is that the moon is a good place to do science from, and one of those areas of science is mainly radio telescopes, because the far side of the moon that never faces the Earth is one of the few places where you cannot watch Survivor or have any of the emissions, radio or TV or other electronic noise that comes off of the Earth. And so it's a wonderful place to do radio astronomy because it's so quiet. And so I think one of the thoughts in establishing outposts on the moon is indeed to explore the far side and see whether you could establish there radio observatories that could help look for and characterize planets around other stars, which is one of the most fascinating things you can look for is evidence of intelligent or any life forms, but particularly intelligent life forms, other places outside our solar system. So there is a science justification for going back to the moon, and that's part of it. The notion, again, I'm on the edge of my knowledge here. I believe that the production of either red or white blood cells does not work as well in the absence of gravity, and that, in fact, there are problems with the human immune system associated with that. And that's the kind of research that we need to do on station, that are we going to put humans at excess risk by sending them away from the Earth? Do we have to provide artificial gravity as a countermeasure to that? Those are all scientific research questions that haven't yet been answered. So that's part of the program is addressing those issues before we commit people to go off to Mars. Militarization. The Bush administration is clearly interested in using space capabilities as an instrument of national power, more so than prior administrations. Does that have anything to do with this exploration initiative? No, or at least not very directly. to the degree it, the exploration initiative helps our technical capabilities, our space industrial base, sure. But the moon is not going to be used as high ground to control the Earth or some of these similar images of the weaponization or of space that are abroad in the land. So I think this particular initiative has nothing to do with space weaponization, space militarization, but certainly this administration is interested in that area of activity.
Well, I heard that the Department of Defense currently is spending more on space projects than NASA.
Well, that's true, but it has nothing to do with space exploration.
Well, that could be, but I mean, your title was space policy.
Oh, sure.
What do you think of this militarization of space?
Well,
in general,
you cannot fight a modern war. Let's take Iraq. Without the use of space assets, weather, communications, and particularly global positioning satellites are key to the precision munitions we use in those wars. Space is militarized and has been militarized almost since the day the first thing was launched into space. To date, space has not been weaponized. There are no systems stationed in space to deliver force on Earth or against another space object, and no capabilities in being on Earth to destroy satellites. There's a real need for a national debate over whether it's intelligent to continue that posture of keeping space as a weapons-free sanctuary. This administration seems to say no. Weapons have followed human activity every other place, and they probably should also be in space. And there is a strong but not very organized counter-movement to that in this country and around the world. And it's I think, one of the crucial debates related to space policy in the coming years.
Well, let me just ask one last question then. If we do go ahead and weaponize space, wouldn't that necessarily mean confrontation with China and Europe and Japan and all these other countries?
It would mean political confrontation. China and Russia, in particular, within the UN system and the Conference on Disarmament, have been introducing draft treaties to prevent an arms race in outer space, and we've refused to negotiate or even discuss those treaties. So there is a political dynamic to this that's very real. War fighting capabilities can coexist with peaceful activities. I think if the nation made a decision to put arms in space, that doesn't prevent us from, for one thing, cooperating with other countries in peaceful uses of space, including space exploration.
We have just 15 minutes left. We have another caller, and I want to encourage anybody else who'd like to come into the conversation to do that. Let me also introduce one more time our guest, John Logsdon. He's director of the Space Policy Institute of George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs and has written a good deal on the history and analysis of space policy. He's going to be here on the campus tomorrow to give a talk on the subject Humans in Space, Past, Present, and Future, sponsored by the College of Engineering. That's tomorrow afternoon at 4 in room 141 of the Loomis Lab of Physics on the U of I campus, and I'm sure anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, the number's here. Next up, Champagne in line one.
Hi. I don't think you've addressed the question of how necessary it is that humans be sent to Mars in order to do the desired scientific research, and I'm not quite sure what that research is. Has it been defined, or is it completely open? And can it be done by technical means?
Sure. Is it necessary to send humans
to Mars?
I understand the question. I think I'm going to give you a slightly off-center answer. I think we will not be satisfied as humans unless some of us eventually travel to places like Mars. Could we do most of the interesting research using robotic systems? Probably over time we could, but you don't give parades for robots. I think there's a human dimension to doing this that transcends the direct instrumental value of scientific discovery. What's the research agenda? It's primarily to find out whether life emerged on Mars at some point in its past history. If we were to find even primitive life forms on Mars, you know, the next planet in one solar system out of many solar systems, it would suggest that life in the universe is a fairly common phenomenon.
I'm wondering about the political dimensions and the ideological dimensions for Bush's evangelical support. But anyway, that's an aside. Thanks a lot. Right.
Sure.
We have now about 7-8 minutes left on the program. If you want to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back to the shuttle for a moment, the shuttle has been around for quite a while now. In fact, the Columbia, the one that was just recently lost, was the first shuttle to fly, and that was back in 1981. Now the decision has been made that as soon as the International Space Station is finished, the shuttle that exists now will be retired. Will there be something to replace it, and what do you think that would be?
The answer is there will be nothing like the shuttle to replace the shuttle anytime soon. When I mean like, a reusable or partially reusable multi-purpose capability. I think there's a recognition that linking carrying cargo and carrying crew in one vehicle was probably a pretty big mistake. It required a vehicle that was very complex to design and risky to operate. So I think what you'll see for 10, maybe 20 years after the shuttle is retired is small crew-carrying vehicles and separate cargo-carrying vehicles with only a limited amount of reusability. Now, the private sector may change that. The private sector is in the early stages of trying to develop a reusable spacecraft. There are issues of the possibility of the emergence of a private business taking people to the edges of space or maybe into orbit, so-called space tourism. But I think for government programs, it's going to be a while before we go back to a very capable, reusable spacecraft.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, great program. My question is, are there any plans to do any exploration or looking out for asteroids that might strike Earth? And the reason I say that is that one big asteroid that came by maybe a decade ago came with only 325,000 miles of our planet. We didn't even know it was there until 2 weeks after it passed by.
Right.
And with Mars being, this is the first time Mars has been this close to the Earth in a long time, maybe that changed that orbit of that particular asteroid.
Well,
I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, these Earth-crossing asteroids, and there are a lot of them, their orbits are not influenced by the gravity of Mars. They operate on different forces. I recently attended a very interesting conference called Planetary Defense, Protecting the Earth from Asteroids, that addressed this issue, and it is it should be part of this initiative. It isn't yet, since this is exploration and learning about these objects is at this point exploratory. I'm personally kind of an advocate for including understanding, characterizing Earth-crossing asteroids and comets as part of this new initiative, because until we understand them, we don't know how to defend against them. It is inevitable.
Yes,
that something will hit the Earth sometime. It's inevitable. Because there's lots of stuff out there, and some of it is going to intersect with our orbit. And if it's a big thing, a kilometer or bigger, it will wipe out civilization, and we can prevent it. So it seems to me it's a hard thing because it's a very improbable event with very high consequences. What kind of insurance do you buy? At this point, we're buying very little.
Well, I can tell you, hope you can continue to be the great advocate for that to be done, because I think it should be done. Thank
you. All right, thank you. Again, we could take one or two more calls. Someone wants to dial us up, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that in some of the things that I've read about what happened with Columbia, there was some concern that maybe the atmosphere of NASA had been affected by having to deal with inadequate funding, and that there had been a lot of outsourcing and that corners had been cut, and that that also was part of the problem. Here we're talking about if we are indeed going to return to the moon and go to Mars, two very ambitious and very expensive projects. Do you think that if we make the decision to do it, that it will be adequately funded? And if not, then does that open up the possibility that we're going to continue to have problems because we simply haven't allocated enough money?
Yeah, well, what Mr. Bush has done with this initiative is put forward a proposal to the American public and their representatives in Congress that asks, do we want to start down this road? It's a choice. Kennedy said this back in 61 when he proposed going to the moon. It's a choice that the people must make of whether in the portfolio of national activities, space exploration has a role. Right now we're funding NASA at 0.7% of the federal budget, and the plan that Mr. Bush has laid out says we don't have to increase that amount very much as long as we're not in a hurry to do this. Would it be nice if there were more money? Sure. Could it be done with the current level of funding? After all, we're spending $6 billion a year, maybe a little more, on human spaceflight now. So the essence of this is to stop spending it the way we're spending it and spend it in a different way, not look for big increases in money. And I think on the timescale that's been laid out, Mars not for another 20 years, it is possible to do this.
Well, there certainly is at least one big difference between that time and this, and that is that at that time, the Cold War was going on, and that drove the decision. There's nothing like that going on now, and it seems that it's more difficult for people to come up with an answer to the why question, other than, and I'm not saying that it's not reasonable, other than pure science. The desire to know more about the universe, the very human desire to explore and to set your foot down on a place where it's never been before, and all those things have certainly driven humans before. But there's nothing, it seems, quite so compelling now as the Cold War was then.
Well, that's very true. I mean, that in a sense, that was easy. We had a strategic competitor for global influence. That competitor defined space as an area where it was winning a race, and President Kennedy said, that's not acceptable. We're going to enter the race and win for a very dramatic space achievement. We don't have anything like that now. It's kind of unfashionable to say what I'm going to say, but I think the main reason the United States wants to do this is pride, is a sense that we as a people are proud of this kind of accomplishment and having a leading role in doing it. It's something that I think humanity recognizes as exciting, as almost defining the species, is this kind of curiosity. And space has become part of the American self-definition. If you look at what we use for symbols of patriotism, it's the flag, the bald eagle, and then some space image, saying this is what we do well, and this is why we get so upset when we don't do it well. I mean, seven young people were killed in Columbia, but seven teenagers were killed in an avalanche the same weekend. That wasn't something that sent the country into mourning. The fact that we're doing this as humans together, I think, is something that defines us as a society.
So you believe that the time will come when a human being stands on the surface of Mars?
Oh, yes. Whether it'll be in my lifetime, I doubt it. But I think the first Mars astronauts are probably in elementary or middle school right now.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Logsdon, for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Look forward to being in Illinois tomorrow.
Well, I want to again mention to people that you'd like to hear more from our guest, John Logsdon. He's director of the Space Policy Institute of George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He'll be giving a talk on the U of I campus tomorrow on the topic Humans in Space, Past, Present, and Future. This is tomorrow afternoon at 4 in 141 of Loomis Lab of Physics on the U of I campus. It's sponsored by the College of Engineering, and I'm sure anyone interested in attending should feel welcome.